Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch."
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Well, Tony Swain, welcome. This is an immense pleasure because you have been, well, you've produced so many tracks that have been part of my, I'm going to say upbringing, but I was well into my 20s by then, so I can't pretend I'm that young. Right. I want to start with your early upbringing and really sort of find out whether you were in a musical family or what type of family were you in? Were they creative in any way, your parents?
My parents, my father, was in the RAF, but he was the entertainment manager based in Ceylon, apart from other things. And he had a band in Ceylon called the Blue Eagles, which I have a picture of. So my father, we had a piano in the house, after I was born a long time ago. And we had a piano in our house. And incredibly enough, we had a Hammond organ with a Leslie in the house, which is fantastic. I started playing drums, and my mother played piano as well, but none of them professionally. And I started playing drums around the age of 11 and was constantly tinkering around, to be honest with you. But so there was a lot of music in the house. Yeah, definitely.
What about you? You got a Revox player very early, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And if you look into my up there, wherever it is, and the other way around, you can see that's an A77 Mark III. Yeah, I got the original G36 valve, which was, if you think it was about 1967, these were like £150, and that was a lot of money then. But the magic of it is you could track bounce, you know. So I basically would, this is how I learned to about multi-tracking, recording myself, you know, having been influenced obviously by the Beatles and everything else. I'd lay the drums down, then I'd lay the Hammond down, and I'd get on my knees and thump the Hammond bass pedals because it was easier. And it was a learning curve on that. And then a bit later on, when I had some money, I invested in the TIAC, the old early four track, which enabled you to, you know, multi-track. And it was, you know, expanding all the time. Yeah.
Going back to the first one you got, how old were you then? Because I remember my parents brought me, you know, it was only like a small cassette with a microphone.
Yes.
And I remember introducing records and then hard cutting the songs on cassette to make it out like I'm a DJ. So, and I was about 11 or 12 back then. I just wondered how old you were.
We had an early, what's called an Elizabethan tape recorder in the house, you know, that would just record, but you all you could do was record, you know. I would have been, the day to the Revox, I would have been 17, 18. And basically, in the period of the time, I was just, you know, fascinated and had a little group and everything, you know.
So although your parents were creative, did they sort of put any weight in terms of a creative life? Because many parents say, you know, well, do that in your private time, but it's not a career.
Totally. I mean, my parents are amazing. They're not here, sadly, anymore. And my father was a printer, actually. You know, he, after the war, he got into that colour printing on polythene and then had a factory in Byfleet. To be honest with you, my mum was a housewife. And to be honest with you, I think he would have liked me to have gone into business. But he also loved the fact that I was doing music. But actually, what happened is that, I wasn't getting anywhere. And it was very tough. And I ended up because straight out of school, after my A levels, I went to the BBC, and then shortly after, got a job at ATV, not as a sound guy, but as a cameraman, because I thought sound and television was a bit tedious. So, but all that time, we were recording or doing things in some manner or form, you know. So, and my father, he was all very worried. I remember him saying when I left ATV, which is a very well-paid job, you know, I was getting well-paid, had a mortgage, I was in my 20s. He said, you know, you're doing the right thing, and are you doing this, and then everything else. But he really, you know, as soon as things started to go well and everything else, because it didn't go well initially, it was extremely hard to make actual living out of the music business. And I worked as an engineer in the studio at 26. I'd started to make tea again after having a great job. But the one thing that touched me is that, you know, my father in his car, and, you know, later on when he died, you know, in his car were all my cassettes, you know, the Imagination records, everything, you know, and he really liked it. So there you go. So
I mean, that's interesting you say that, because actually you've just mentioned Imagination, and I connect a story from Lee, Lee John,
the great Lee,
as well. Yeah, and he talked about his father, who he didn't really have a close relationship, but when his father died and he went through all his stuff in St. Lucia, he found a box of clippings of his life, which was a totally sort of moving story. And I had a really sort of dysfunctional relationship with my father. I mean, he left when I was very young, but when he died and he was on his deathbed, he told me that he'd always loved me, which was something that he'd never done before.
Right.
And I think we're from that sort of generation
where
it's sort of where we didn't really speak to our parents like people do today. Was that the same in your household?
Yeah, I think this is, I call it the Ladybird book generation. Mum's doing the ironing. It's a typical dad goes out to work. And my father was working a lot, and he used to come in, but he you know, wore a suit all the time. And he, you know, he wasn't, my mother was completely opposite. He wasn't, he was a lovely man, but not tactile, because of that generation. It was all, you know, I go to work and I come in and everything else. But yeah, and it's funny how little you know about your parents until later on. And he, yeah, it was, it's interesting, but he was proud of me. At his funeral, somebody came up to me and said, oh yes, you're, he was called Cyril, you know, you're Cyril's son. And he said, yeah, he considered you his best friend. I mean, you know, when you find out at your own father's funeral that your dad thought that I was his best friend. So that, you know, that's quite incredible, really. But yeah, interesting if is this a very interesting conversation, not works, but interesting psychologically, if that drives you towards wanting success or, you know, all those things. But I was just determined. I was just so fascinated with the music business. My grandfather, I have to say, it must be in the genes, going way back in my family. My one of my great 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 ancestors was a famous clockmaker and scientist and an inventor. And so my grandfather made radiograms and you know, on the side. So it's all in you. And I was just fascinated by the whole recording process and everything that went with it. You know, so
I mean, you mentioned drive and how that important is, and also where that comes from, because I always believe when I've interviewed so many pop stars in my life and done so much research on them that I've always sort of seemed to find out there is a childhood wound. And I think we all have childhood wounds in a way, however big or small they are, they're there, and they're the things that sort of drive us. The other thing that we have is when we're teenagers, we hook on to an artist often. For me, it was David Bowie, because I was a young teenager in the early 70s. And of course, Bowie came along. And for me, he not only his music, but he represented a world where I could feel my or be myself and get away from my parents' world. Did you have a hero in your teenage years that represented in a way where you wanted to go?
Oh, yes. Well, I think in my it has to be the it has to be the Beatles and the just the recording process and how they turned. I mean, I listen to them still, and if you listen to the early albums and, you know, their first single, which wasn't a hit, and I remember seeing them on television perform it live, Love Me Do, and I mean, it's a minor hit, but the whole thing about this sort of recording an album in 2 days with the band and everything else, a change to them using a four-track machine as a creative instrument. And I think it's interesting because I have this conversation with colleagues now that because we're creative people and, you know, I songwrite as well as produce and play, it's that we have a sort of, it's not that we're, you know, better or from another planet or anything else. We don't feel we think the same as other people. And you know, we're sort of conforming to things and routines is quite difficult. And I think that this is, you know, the sort of the regimentation of early childhood school and the whole thing that was going on in the 50s and 60s. And outside, you know, then there was this, you know, like these albums were coming out with all this noise and you know, hippiness and everything else. And it was just like, wow, this is where I belong. I don't belong here. I wasn't put on this planet, although I did work, you know, I worked for my father on the vans and saved up for my first Philips cassette recorder, which I recently restored. Can you believe? Yes, I think it, and it, I think it's a driving thing. I mean, you know, I went to some nice schools, not private, but I didn't love it. And I, you know, sort of doing exams, I hated it all and everything else. You know, I just wanted to be creative and carry on, you know, do that sort of thing.
Have you always listened to music differently from other people, do you think?
I'll be honest with you, because of the exposure to it in my childhood, where my parents would go and see My Fair Lady, or, you know, the music, or Russ Conway would be number one, you know, with Side Saddle or something like that. I think I was exposed to a lot of easy listening stuff, you know, whether it be, you know, Mantovani, what have you, or an early jazz, you know. One of my mother and father's friends, the father, I went round to their house, and their daughter was, we were at school together, and he had a record deck with a leak amplifier built into a cabinet, which I thought was fantastic. But he played Oscar Peterson, and I was exposed to jazz there, and I thought, you know, I really love this. This is fantastic. So, yeah, it was very much, you know, an absorption of everything, because and that certainly, it certainly got into me, because even in people have asked me about this in Body Talk at the end of it, there's some really sad strings that go, you know, da-da, like this, da-da. And that is without a doubt the, you know, sort of early exposure to Michel Legrand, sort of, you know, that type of thing, because I think that, you know, to all these genres creep into everything. You know, it doesn't matter what you say. You people tag it, oh, it's R&B or it's hip hop or it's, you know, jazz. But it's, yeah, it's a fusion of everything. Yeah,
I mean, you mentioned you went first of all to the BBC, then you were at ATV, and I presume that's where you were cameraman on the Muppets.
It is, yes, yeah. It was, yeah.
With Jim Henson, who was the boss of the Muppets. What? I mean, you know, I mean, everyone knows the Muppets, obviously. Yes. They've been around for centuries, it feels like. So what was it like working on the Muppets? Was that just a job and something that you really weren't that keen on, or was it something that you had some passion for?
It was one of the best 8 years of my life. The people I worked with were just incredible, and I'm friends still with a lot of them. Unfortunately, some of them passed away, but it was unbelievable. We'd never the people think the Muppets were shot in America, and they weren't. They were shot in Elstree in ATV studios there. The first thing we did, and we were doing a lot of shows for America because we were working in colour in dual standard, PAL and NTSC, way before the BBC. So, you know, Tom Jones was delivered in colour. We were doing all these specials, and all these American artists would come over. It was fantastic. But the first thing we did was Julie Andrews and Sesame Street. And they built Sesame Street in the studio. So we went, oh, wow, look at this, because satellite at that time, in the late, there was no satellite in the UK, you know, or anything really. So we weren't exposed that much to American exported TV programs. And so they built the set and we did all this stuff. And then we'd never seen anything like it. Firstly, the first thing we saw is that the Americans would build the puppet or Muppet stages 3-4 foot in the air, so they could not crouch down like everybody was doing in the UK. And the other thing is they'd use on the Big Bird and stuff like that, they had radio links and monitors inside the costumes so they could see what they were doing. But the Muppet guys were just unbelievable. I mean, you know, there's Jim Henson, Frank Oz, who went on to direct lots of things, and they were just lovely people. And absolutely brilliant at what they did. I mean, we would laugh. I'd find it difficult not to laugh, because when you're holding a camera, you can't laugh because you just, you know, shake up and down. Some of the stuff we did was just hilarious. And of course, there's the outtakes of there are some outtakes, God knows what happened to them, of Fozzie Bear and Kermit and Miss Piggy. After the cameras stopped rolling, I won't get any further than that, but I think they've been buried somewhere. So, but they were, yeah, it was a special time and a great sort of honor. My, you know, at the time my parents came and visited, I have a picture of my mother and myself with Kermit and Miss Piggy, you know, the real, and it was a great time, but it was work, and it was hard work, because you know you're standing in the studios all day and everything else. I mean, I saw Alice Cooper, Peter Sellers, John Wayne. We saw Glen Campbell, Gene Kelly did Singing in the Rain, and you know, one of my claims to fame is I was there when we shot David Bowie and Bing Crosby doing the duet that they did.
And the Christmas song, wasn't it?
The Christmas, yeah. And seeing Bing sing Last Christmas.
Yeah, it was Little Drummer Boy, wasn't it?
Right, yeah, yes, it was, for the last time. And he died 3 weeks later. So, you know, and some of these stuff is happening. Like making records, you know, it's a long process to make an album, and you know, you've got a track that you keep revisiting and sort of, you know, going back anyway. So
yeah, I'll come on to that in a second. Yeah. I just want to talk about, because working in that environment, that's where you met Steve Jolly, wasn't it?
Correct. Yeah, Steve was a sound guy. Yeah.
What connected you? Because there, you know, to work together later on, there must have been a connection between you. So. What connected you? Was it music? Was it just working there? What was it?
Well, it was we formed a band called Chaser, and Steve we knew was a singer, and he was in the sound department. So we and Brian Grant, who was also a cameraman, and Brian later, you know, went on to direct Olivia Newton-John's Physical, Whitney Houston's, you know, You Got a Dog, Duran Duran things, and everything else. And he was the drummer in the band, and we got. When we were all working at ATV, we got signed to Polydor on a record contract. And even last week, I've never seen it before. Somebody sent me a picture of the session in Polydor that we did. And you just go, oh my God. And it was filmed. I've got the sound off the film, but not the film. But, you know, we can't find it anywhere.
I was listening to one of the tracks, Red Rum.
That's it. Oh, which is you're very brave, Steve. You're very brave.
Well, I was going to say to you, and I mean this in a polite and nice way, it didn't really musically have any of the promise which was later to come.
No, certainly not. But it was the story of that, as you brought it up, is that Peter Sains produced that, who had produced You're a Lady by Peter Skellum. And it was like, the excitement of going into a studio, we were going into a 16 track studio into Polydor, which was in Stratford Street, and where Jimi Hendrix, they showed us the Jimi Hendrix multi-tracks and the now used syringes for oiling the machines, you know, so they were in a sort of like, how can I put it, an altar to sort of Jimmy in there. But so it was just terrifically an exciting time for us. And we'd written this track and there was a few connections and Polydor, so yeah, let's go with it. And then I thought I'd had a heart attack because the horse lost the race. And Polydor were in force at Aintree with T-shirts. And as soon as in the horse was going to win the race, they were just going to open the coats with the record on. Radio One had banned it as a sports record, believe it or not, but we're playing it on trailers. So it was selling, actually. And then it just, that was it. So we did some further recordings, but in the end, I think it's when Wayne Bickerton, who later on, you know, became a friend, was head of A&R Polit, but he was like, we used to get chucked out for the rubettes, you know, of the studio. You know, they just said, what are we going to do with them? You know, so they just dropped us, you know, as they do. So that was the end of our Polydor career. So.
Most people in their lives have a mentor who you know, who brings things to them, techniques into what their future will be, and so on and so forth. Was there one in your life, someone that actually was able to bring you the idea of what production is, or bring the idea of sound and so on and so forth?
Well, I think that, if you imagine that the Redbus is where I went to initially, was being built by Tom Hidley, who was a famous studio builder. He did studios called Eastlake, all beautiful, all shagbark carpets, you know, rocks everywhere, like a sort of very American looking. But this was a state of the art studio and was to become, you know, very important later on. So I'd taken the plunge and gone, I'm going, this is what I want to do. I left ATV and I just thought, I can't, I'm going to be honest with myself and I'm going to give it a go. But of course, I had experience, I had musical experience, and I knew how to, you know, I had a bit of studio experience and multi-track. But when you're faced with a full-on studio and the techniques and the outboard gear and all the microphones and the orchestras, etc., there's a lot to learn, really, about, you know, doing this. So it was very difficult for me because I'd been in an environment where, you know, I had a lot of friends and it was a fantastic time, to seeing a studio constructed, you know, with builders. And basically I'd gone down the ladder to the T-boy. So, and I was the assistant. But Jeff, a guy called Jeff Calver, who had produced the Walker Brothers and Lindsay DePaul and was a fantastic engineer, he really helped me a lot by teaching me what you do and what you don't do, you know, with compressors and reverb and gates and microphones. And where do you think you stick a microphone on the flute? Well, you know, you stick it above in the air and think, what is the correct way? What microphones do you use on violas rather than violins and cellos and trumpets and saxophones and this stuff? So I ended up learning a lot from him. And then I would engineer and I could get great drum sounds because I was a drummer. So I'd be working with Barry Blue or any great producers that were around, and I'd be sitting there going, after a while of years of doing this, and it was hard work because it was like day and night, you know, I was exhausted, and we'd use dead time to record, and after watching them I thought, I can do this, you know, I know what to do now, I know how to get these sounds and everything else. So I talked the owners into, and we were signed to them as producers, writers at the time and everything else. I taught them, I said, look, I don't want to do this anymore. Tomorrow I want to be known as a record producer and that's all I want to do. So, and they said, okay. And at the time, Trident Studios had headhunted me and said, you know, because I was getting work because of the sounds I could get and everything else. And it's... And I went to talk to them and they said, well, we're going to pay you, I don't know, some ludicrous amount of money, way more than you're getting now. And I just thought, yeah, okay, well, I'll be engineering, Elton John, Queen, whatever. But I will not be able to go into the production, use the dead time and the other stuff. And I made the decision. I went, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to try and survive here on 2/3 less salary than I was getting at ATV. And 12 weeks later, they went down, Trident. So that was a lucky escape. So so that was it. That was a transition. So it was a case of, and I think the problem today it's not a problem because I admire a lot of the work that's being done today. I mean, there's, you know, in the all been done on laptops and the processing and everything else. But that grounding of actually, you know, some people have, some guys today have had massive hits. They've never seen a real trumpet. You know, they've never mic'd up a real trumpet. And it's to understand how these things interact with other outboard gear, like limiters and compressors and reverb. And actually reverb is an extremely important part of making records. And if you misuse it, it can be disastrous. You know? So things like that. So, I mean, these are... Sorry, go on.
I just want to go back to Jeff Kalber, who worked with the Walker Brothers. Yes. Because you mentioned he said to you there is a right way of miking, I think it was a trombone or something, on instrument.
Or a flute or anything.
Sorry,
yeah,
of miking something, and a wrong way. But I know whenever you're learning something, you need rules.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And actually, yes, by breaking the rules is you create something different. So when was the point that you reached that you broke the rules rather than went by the rules?
Well, I think you need to, that's a very good point, Steve, because what I'm saying is you need to know how to do it properly before you can start to create yourself and break the rules. And once you know what this equipment can do and its capabilities, then you can start to push it, and you can push it because in the early days when there was no CDs and we were making vinyl, there were parameters you had to stick to. Otherwise, when you went to the cutting room, the cutting engineer would say, well, the bass is making the cut bounce. You know, you can't put things like that extreme left and right, or the hi-hat's breaking up the cutting head, you know. So there were issues like that, and it was very important that you went to the cutting room to learn about what the parameters were of the vinyl. And so I did that as well. But your question, very interesting. I think I started to, it all started to come together because we were doing this dead time recording and everything else. And that's when, well, Body Talk was created at that time, but was part of something else. And I sort of thought, well, if you wind the compressor up a bit, the bass drum really sounds, you know, really wacky. And if you do this, and if you put, I'd listen to your earlier question, because I've listened to a lot of American things, even like Tony Bennett, right? You know, I Left My Heart in San Francisco. There's this enormous splashback reverb, you know, it's almost like, and I thought, how do they do this? Well, they use a thing called pre-delay or tape going into the reverb unit. So they delay the sound going to the reverb, which is what I used later on in the Spandau True. You know, that's what that is. It's his voice being splashed back through the reverb. So I started to push the parameters, and, you know, we had a harmonizer, which was an early digital pitch changing thing, you know, and it was very expensive. Everything was expensive. An AMS delay unit that would capture, you know, a clap or something, one sound that was like, we had to figure, you know, these things were 10 to 15,000, you know, just for one unit. But I started then to get creative and go, okay, you can do this, you can do that, you can push this, and we can wind these things up and change the sound of that within the limits. And then it's funny because then things started to happen, and, you know, everything else. And there were some great people working around. Colin Thurston was producing the early Duran records in Redbus. Martin Russian was doing Human League in there. And we were all chatting and going, and Colin would go in, he'd come in and go, oh. Simon Le Bon was staying with Colin because Colin was trying to help Simon develop as a singer and everything else. And he came, Colin came into me and he said, what do I do about this? And how can I create an artificial double track? And what, any ideas? And we'd just converse and go, do this, try that, you know, put the harmonizer on it, speed the machine up and down, do, you know, we had no autotune for a long, long time. And I'm not saying Simon needs autotune, and so basically we were all talking to each other about what bits of new gear could do, how you did this, and that sort of thing. Yeah,
I mean, that's amazing, because Martin Rush and Colin Thurston and yourself, I mean, three of the major producers of that era that you're talking about, who actually dominated the charts. And you always, well, I'm saying you always, I always have this imagination of there being some competition, people being wary of, like, they've created a new sound that may be like something really successful, so I don't want so-and-so to have it. But the way you're describing it is a much more sort of open thing, where you're able to communicate to each other. Was there a security in the sense you're working with a specific artist? I'm asking this in terms of you thinking about them as well. Working with a specific artist and knowing what was good for them, and that, so that didn't really matter. You couldn't really pass that over, because it wouldn't sound the same with Spandau as it would with Duran Duran, as it would with the Human League.
Yeah, you'd get a situation, especially with the sound that we were, you know, the bass sound, which was the thing I played on the Imagination Records and created that sound. And we then used it maybe on a Bananarama record. And you'd get it sometimes from the artist. They go, you know, they'd hear the record and they go, oh, it sounds like one of our sounds, or it sounds like, so yes, it wasn't. And funny enough, Cruel Summer was a track that we had, and I, not that he's made a mistake, but I offered it, you know, we offered it to Lee, and he said, I can't see it really, but it wasn't in any state as it ended up, you know.
Nice buns, soft, fluffy, and ultra low net carbs. Discover Hero Bread, the delicious ultra low net carb bread with incredible taste and texture. Hero Bread has 0 grams of sugar and is under 100 calories per serving. Plus, high in fiber with 5 to 10 grams of protein per serving. Available on Amazon.com, Walmart.com, and at Hero.co. That's Hero.co. Delicious, ultra-low net-carb Hero Bread buns and tortillas. Soft and fluffy, high in fiber, and with 0 grams of sugar. Up to 10 grams of protein, coming in at under 100 calories. Order today at Hero.co and use the code AH10 to get 10% off your first purchase. That's AH10 at Hero.co. Hero.co. Order from Hero.co now and get 10% off your first purchase with promo code AH10. That's 10% off with code AH10. Hero.co.
Breast milk science. It's a thing. And it's our thing. We're ByHeart. We're an infant formula company on a mission to get a lot closer to the most super food on the planet, breast milk. Our patented protein blend has more of the important and most abundant proteins found in breast milk. We're the first and only U.S.-made formula to use organic, grass-fed whole milk, not skim. We make our formula in our own factories in Iowa, Oregon, and Pennsylvania, using a small batch manufacturing process that works to preserve the integrity of our ingredients. We ran the largest clinical trial by a new infant formula company in 25 years and clinically proved benefits like easier digestion, less gas, and softer poops versus a leading infant formula. We were the first infant formula company to earn the Clean Label Project Purity Award. And while we've put a lot into ByHeart, there's a long list of things you won't see on our ingredient list, like no corn syrup, no maltodextrin, no GMO ingredients, no soy, no palm oil. ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Be a barbecue hero with delicious, ultra-low net-carb Hero Bread buns and tortillas. Soft and fluffy, high in fiber, and with 0 grams of sugar, up to 10 grams of protein, coming in at under 100 calories per serving. Oh, and did I mention they taste like their mouth-watering traditional versions? I mean, what's not to love? Use code AH10 for 10% off your first Hero Bread purchase at Hero.co. That's AH10 for 10% off at Hero.co.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Imagination is where it really took off. Can you remember meeting Lee John and what your impression was of him, you know, the first time you met him?
Steve, no one can ever forget when they meet Lee John. This is for sure. That's all I can say. He is, I'm going to say this because we're still friends and good friends and, you know, have helped each other. he's an amazing singer, and an amazing person, and one of the hardest working people I've ever met. And he incredible. And when I met him, his character was just like larger than life. And this whole situation before Body Talk was, I think they'd made a track with Trevor Horn, who I remember meeting Trevor, who came in with his shoulder bag, and we had a quick chat and everything else. And the this is an incredibly classic story. So I can't remember the title, but they'd made the track and then sent it to America, the multi-track, for remixing, and it never came back. So that was a problem. And then Morgan Kahn, was then, he was sort of involved with Redbus. They sort of did a co-deal on a thing, an R&B deal for the R&B label. And what happened is that I had already had Body Talk as an instrumental track. The thing is, at the time that had different bass and everything else, and then I started to work on it. It was basically an instrumental that went, da 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 with the piano, and I just, there was something about it. Everyone was going, "Why aren't you using slap bass on it? Why?" What is that synth bass on it? Why are you doing that? Why are you doing things that are different? Or why is it so slow? And I said, I'd listened to Rise by Herb Alpert, which was, I could tell what was happening over there. And I thought, no, this sounds great slow, it came together because of the hand claps and everything else. Anyway, to cut the long story short, I had that on a cassette and took it home, and nothing was happening to it. It was going to be John Curry, Anthony Curry skating theme or something. I don't know what was happening. And it was just like I went into the living room. I could see the cassette on the shelf, and it was just like going, do something with me. Anyway, I took it back in, and then Morgan, I think, or one of the guys there, gave it to Lee, and they worked on a lyric for it. And then it was one of those, okay, these guys, so I meet Lee, he's going, darling, everything else. And, I thought, okay, great, let's try this. And we literally did it in a day, half a day. We put the Body Talk, the vocals on. And then it was recorded in its long format. All the imagination tracks were recorded long, as 6 minutes and everything else. And so not cut into 12s from singles, which is a whole different, ballpark thing. So we'd put the vocals on it and everything else, and thought, yeah, sounds great. It's, fantastic and the thing. And then I sat with Morgan Kahn, and we, it was great. I mixed it, but he was very helpful because he was going to the clubs all the time, and he was going, the bass, let's you get the bass at the right level, and you go, as you would mix a record, and then you go, yeah, let's go higher. So it's like, okay, this sounds great and it sounds right, but no, let's push it higher. And we did. So it was featured on the thing, and because the bass and the claps were the big thing about it. And if you saw how the claps were done, myself and my engineer, Richard Nengel, was, sitting at the desk with a microphone hanging over the top, just going like for hours, like ourselves, and tracking it up, because there wasn't an efficient clap sampler at the time. And everything, there was no...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There was no sequencing, no computers used in any of those early records, not even just Illusion. It was just hard graft trying to keep in time. And we used the Lynn drum a bit later on.
When do you know to stop the risk? Because obviously risk is an important factor to push the boundaries, to increase the bass sound until it's like, you know, an oddity, like you sort of mentioned before, something which is unusual. When do you know when to stop and say, okay, this is ready?
I think if you, as a producer, it's funny because I've always said to people in a studio, I can make decisions and direct everything. I know exactly where I'm going and what I want, you know, but if anyone asks me, you know, what color carpet do you think we should have? Forget it. You know, it's just like, you know, it's just like that. I can't even think about it. But I think if it's doing nothing for you as a producer, if you're not sitting there going, oh my God, this sounds fantastic, and I've never heard anything like it. Or if you play the mix back and you just go, it's a bit boring, isn't it? And the thing is, I had to develop myself because I'd played on that particular record. Graham Jarvis, who's no longer sadly with us, a great drummer, had drummed on it. And I played everything else on it myself. So you get to the point there where you're sitting at a desk and you went, oh, that overdub there took 3 days. This bass took 2 days, whatever. And you're going, actually, it's rubbish, and getting rid of it. You've got to be that harsh with what your own work. And I think that and until you're blown away yourself. And also, it's important to take it home. You know, listen to a mix in a normal environment, the car, the house, and everything else, or on small speakers. I mean, because if it doesn't blow you away in every environment, you know, obviously a club, it will blow you away because there's the volume. That's when you know. You just know. But you don't know whether things are going to be hits or not. You really don't. It doesn't matter what anybody says. I've revisited tracks where someone's asked me to do an edit or something after they've been a big hit, and it's like you get the tape out and it's got sparkles on it. You know, it's just like it's been blessed. You know, I can't explain it, but there's no way you just. I mean, true. When they the first time we worked with Spandau was with Lifeline, and then they asked us to do the True album, and then when we got round to True as a single, I was in shock. I just said, are you serious? That's 6 minutes long and it's a ballad, you know. I mean, radio, but, you know. So I did more work on it, but anyway.
Did you try and cut that down, True? Because, it, you know, I think it was 5.5 to 6 minutes, I think.
It was over 6 minutes.
Yeah,
a minute out of it. But the worst cut down I ever did, which was really difficult, was Just Illusion, because that was 5 to 6 minutes that had to be cut to 3. So you trim, you do this, and then you have to put sometimes overhang pieces that you know, you do a cut, but it cuts something else. You have to redo an instrument or move it. It was very hard. And this was physical tape cutting as well, razor blading it, you know.
Well, so, where do you have to stand back from self-belief and ego and compromise with an artist?
Oh, dear. Well, are you talking about myself or the artist?
Well, so, both ways. I mean, it's obviously from both sides. Otherwise, you're never going to get anything come out.
Well, I think that you have a feeling about what works and what doesn't work. And there are formulas. And formulas, when they've been successful, are difficult to break. So then you get criticised for making the same record. The review of Just an Illusion, I mean, the reviews are fantastic of your records, because it just, and you just look back and go, you know, whatever, that's what you thought. The two reviews I remember, one was on Just Illusion, which said more hand clapping drivel from Swain and Jolly, and the review of the Alison Moyet Alf album, which, you know, was very successful, said like listening to soup in the basket.
How did that make you feel?
Well, I just, not great, but the thing is, it's like, you know, you just go, okay, let's keep our fingers crossed. You know, the proof's in the pudding, isn't it? And the thing is it's like film critics, you know, having just seen Babylon, I'm quite shocked at the film critics' opinion of it, you know, that it's what they think, and actually the public are completely different. I mean, it's funny because the Night Dubbing album, which was the I didn't want to do it, you know, but the record company said, look, you know, and it was an early remix album, you know, using new techniques, everything else. And it was hard work because we'd done that. We'd done the 12 inches, the edit, where they'd been hits. We would dig this all out and revisit it. And I went, oh, no. Nobody was doing that at that time. You know, it was 1983 or something. But we all I remember is we just hired every piece of gear we could get our hands on, anything that was new, anything that did anything crazy. And we just went nuts. And I have to say that, you know, we finished it and I went, OK, we'll put it out. And I was shocked. That album went in at like number 9. And I knew something was right because I remember in the summer going into a car park in a field and it was some event. And then I was sitting waiting. And then I over there in another car, I could hear the album Night Dubbing. And I went, there you go. So you sometimes you, what I'm saying to you is you don't. You think you know, and you don't know yourself, you know. So you can't always predict anything. Otherwise, we'd be having hits nonstop, you know. So,
I mean, Imagination were hugely successful. And I'm just wondering how that changed your life then.
Oh, wow. Yes, it did. And like all things, when you start a career, you can have success, as in the charts, but the money, you know, the money doesn't come till sometime afterwards. Not that that was the issue, because it was never about that. Anybody doing music never goes into the business for money, that's for sure. It did change, yeah. Because
but suddenly, did you become suddenly in? You know, everyone wanted to work with you.
Yes, it was.
Didn't Madonna
crazy.
Want to work with you as well?
Yes, yeah. I mean, the when we did it, Imagination, Bananarama. What happened is that the Imagination were dominating the dance and pop charts. This was the key that set everybody going, hold on a minute. These are pop dance records and they're going into all charts, you know. So that's when it was that point, I think, particularly with especially Just an Illusion, is that then we had Spandau wanted to work with us and Bananarama initially and all sorts of things. And Madonna she absolutely loved Imagination. And so we were, I was, you know, she wanted to work with us, but it was a time aspect because we were so busy, you know, we were so busy. And we never said no to her. I just said, we can't do it until August. But she was phoning me every day in the studio, literally saying, you know, when are you going to come? And I met, you know, we had a meeting with her manager, our managers at the time. After she did Top of the Pops Holiday, we met her at 11, 12, and she played her demos and everything else. And Seymour Stein, who was the head of Sire Records at the time, he said, I met him later because obviously she did the Steinberg and Kelly track, Like a Virgin, which what broke her, you know, as a huge pop artist. And I don't think that, no disrespect to her at all, she's an amazing artist. I don't think we would have lasted more than 3 records, to be honest with you, because she loves to move on and she's very clever. She goes, they're the best. I want them, you know, whether it's William Orbit or anybody else. She's very smart. So I think she just thought, these guys are getting huge hits, pop and dance. I want to work with them. And so that's what happened. So it was, yeah. But I went later on, I said to Seymour Stein, I'm talking about 3 years later, I said, can you believe, Seymour, you know, that we didn't work with her in the end? He said, so what? He said, you did the Alison Moyet album. That was great. So, you know.
You mentioned Bananarama, about working with them. Bananarama, yeah. I mean, I love Bananarama because they had this sort of appearance like, I mean, I knew them from the clubs in any case, yes, at that point. But yeah, they were like regular girls, a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But they were very much portrayed as not having a lot of talent, which, yeah, I think has been seen differently over the years, yeah, now. At the time, what was it like working with them and what were they like?
Well, it was an experience. What can I say? I mean, the thing is, we wrote the first single. They weren't involved in that, which was what happened is that we wrote this single, which was called Shy Boy, and the chorus, it was Steve and I were working on the record and we were in Red Bus Studios And it was originally called Big Red Motorbike. So the chorus didn't go, don't it make you feel good? It went, on your big red motorbike. And I turned, I said, it didn't go down well. I said, Steve, this is just crap, you know. And we had a bit of a row about that. And anyway, then that was very creative. You know, we could have a row, go, you're right, it is crap. So we said, let's do something Motown-ish. Don't it make you feel good? You know, dancing in the street, you know, that's what we did. So we got them in. They wanted to work with us because of the imagination stuff, and that was fine. And we soon learned that the best way to record them was to get them to sing together. We tried individually miking them. That didn't work. And it was just a sound that what it was. I mean, it sounds a bit like the sixth form girls singing. You know, it's got a sound. You track it up and do a few harmonies, manipulate the backing vocals. But we put it up the desk, and you know, there were lots of drums and percussion and stuff, because we'd sort of, you know, really saying something had come before us, and we thought we have to sort of honour that sort of progression. But I put it up the desk, and I listened to Really Saying Something. And I thought, oh my god, you know, ours sounds so squeaky clean and nice, and even though it got the toms and stuff. So I literally went through the entire desk channel at the time, screwing in mid-range, you know, crunchy things, and then did a rough mix that night. I don't even think it was the right, you know, it was like not a master thing, so it was like 7.5 inches per second rough mix, and never bettered it. So the rough mix of that night was what went out. So and that was that story. And then we got working with them again. And I enjoyed working with them, but they had their own issues and, you know, things themselves and everything else. But it was good. We did a lot of work with them, you know, 4 years of it. And
I mean, one of the tracks you worked on was Robert De Niro's Waiting, wasn't it? Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, and interesting, the video, Robert De Niro's Waiting, but John Travolta lookalikes in the video, you know. and I've got the pictures. I don't know where someone, Sarah, sent it to me, of the girls with Robert De Niro in the pub. I mean, Robert De Niro he looks like startled, to be honest with you. And look, one of the girls said to me, I think that Robert was quite keen on Karen, you know, and Karen said, well, if you think, you know, think of going out with him, that'll, you know, whatever, you know. So basically and we had this whole thing with the, after we had this big hit with Shy Boy, and we were working on Na Na Hey Hey, you know, which was a cover, we'd recorded it, and then we just had a phone call saying, we don't want to work with you anymore. And we were just like stunned. And so we went, okay. They went off and worked with Barry Blue, who did Cheers then, which, you know, was a winning at 40. And then he started fiddling around with Na Na Hey Hey, or they did. But fortunately, I'd made a tape copy of it, a multi-track copy of it. And then we had a phone call, said, this is how this went. We want to meet you in the pub. So we all go in the pub, and it's like, it's not like normal sort of thing. They go, yeah, we want to work with you again. So we started working with you again, you know, them again. We did Na Na Hey Hey. And even when we went round to write songs, we'd knock on their door in the flats near Holborn, and they'd open the door, and they'd be watching television as if like we're in the neighbourhood, and popped around and said, we'd go in, they go, do you want toast? And we go, yeah, that'd be nice. Just like, it was like that. But they are great. There was only one Bananarama, I have to say. So,
but yeah, okay. To be fair on artists, I think not everyone knows exactly what they want, so that you can make today. You might go, oh, well, actually, let's not work with them. Let's go this way. Let's do this. And then, if you don't exactly know where you're going or what you want to do, you can make different decisions. Is it difficult to? Do you have to personally change to deal with a different artist's ego and needs and wants?
Yeah, I think that you sometimes you work with an artist and they're unknown, and then they become very well known during your time working with them, and that can be difficult. But we didn't change. So if they were misbehaving, we just ignore them, you know. So the thing with the, I mean, just skipping back to Bananarama, is that they were doing so much, and they were getting more and more tired, and we were running out of ideas, because basically this fun band, they were now writing lyrics about problems in Ireland and friends who had died and drug issues, and it was like, yeah, okay, this is not really, you know, what's happening. And then they asked us to do Venus, and we just said, you know, we just can't do anymore. You know, we're done with it, and we can't offer you anything different, and we don't want to do Venus. And of course, that was a number one in America, and Pete Waterman took over. But I mean, Pete thinks he invented them, and of course, you know, he didn't. But no disrespect to Pete, but you know, he forgets there was a huge amount that went on. I mean, like Funboy 3, you know, should take the credit for them, really.
Yeah.
But you know, but every artist is different, and as a producer, and if you're recording vocals, you're not going to change the artist's vocal abilities when they've got a voice. And there's one thing you can do is make them feel, as long as they're prepared, make them feel relaxed, make them feel at home, make them sure they've got the best headphone balance that they want, because they get very wound up. It's very difficult, you know, pitching when you're recording vocals. You know, you take one earphone off or one door, and it's you're trying to guide people. And it can be very hard, you know, very hard. You do multiple takes of vocals, and you get a word from there and a line from there and everything else. But
that's
not
what
easy.
Happened in True, wasn't it, with Tony Hadley, that you had to multiple record his voice and then do drop-ins.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the same with everybody. I mean, it's not unique to Tony. Tony, I mean, because it was a difficult vocal. And I was working on the music. Steve recorded that vocal in Red Bus Studio One, and all I remember, we were waiting. You know, I said, "Look, you know, I've got all this thing to do, and you've been at this for 3 to 4 days now." And I said, "Have you finished?" And he went, "They came out as if they, you know, been down a pothole for 8 days." You know, I mean, they were exhausted, but it doesn't matter, because the end result, it's great, you know. So it doesn't matter how you get that result. It's like filmmaking. I mean, people think that filmmaking is a pleasure. It's very arduous, you know.
But there are some artists that just walk into the studio, you know, like the famous story with Tina Turner,
yes.
You know, who walked into the studio with Martin Ware and just, you know, recorded it. He thought it was a practice.
Yes.
Go through. Yes. And for her, that was it. It was done, you know. Yeah. It was. Well,
you do. I mean, with Alison, she was always eager to sort of finish and go home. And she's got she's a fantastic singer and has got a great voice, and she could, you know, deliver it pretty quickly. And there's lots of soul singing, you know, that. And Lee is great. You don't, you know, people can just deliver it, and then you go, well, let's do that a bit, let's do that a bit. But it can change, you know, circumstances can change, and they can, you know, be difficult and everything else. And also, it's what's going on in their life. You know, if they've had a terrible journey to the studio, they can be very wound up, you know, and they just can't do it. And sometimes you have to make the decision, let's come back tomorrow and do it, you know, let's do it another time. So,
well, you know, working with Alison Moyet on that album, Alf, I mean, she'd made her name with Vince Clarke in Yazoo with tracks like Don't Go, which is this sort of amazing sound, and had a sound that went with her voice. Now, as a solo artist, she needed to develop a new sound for herself, I presume, as well.
Yeah.
How involved were you? Were there discussions about where she should place herself and how she should sound?
Yeah, I mean, we had a meeting with Muff Winwood, which was CBS at the time, and he was for quite at the time. Lamont Dozier had written Invisible for her, and Lamont Dozier had actually started recording Invisible, but it wasn't going how they wanted, and so we went into this meeting to discuss the whole thing. And Muff was quite clear. He saw it as sort of Dusty Springfield type, you know, thing, and not, you know, song driven. modern and everything else. But we, the what happened is we started recording, and you know, we Love Resurrection came out, and that was, you know, reasonable hit, about number 12 or something. And so the ball was rolling, and then we were just recording in the studio. We were given a time sort of factor of January or February in the year, when this was about September. And I had a call, something Paul Young was recording, and that had gone wrong, something, or it was delayed. And we had a call saying, from Muff, going, we're going to need this album, you know, before Christmas, and we're going to need it in the next 2 weeks. Now, we were well in, recorded half the album. All Cried Out was a B-side, and it was designated as a B-side. And, you know, there was so much pressure on Alison and ourselves, to be honest with you. And so, but we pulled it together, and we got out, and it was number one at Christmas. So, you know, it was fantastic. But it caused a lot of pressure, and also, you know, I don't know what happened there. We could have made another album with her, but she didn't like it. She didn't like the album. And the story I've heard, whether it's true or not, she listened to it in her car on the cassette, and that went straight out the window. I mean, incredible. Now she feels a bit better about it. I've talked to her since, but I think I don't know if she felt manipulated or what, or she wasn't what she wanted to do, because there was a period where she ended up doing things she didn't want to do, the jazz thing and Old Devil Called Love. She didn't want to do that. And then she made all these other albums and everything else. But and Rain, the point is, our album sold the most and cost the least. And then the Rain Dancing album, which a friend of mine, Jess Bailey, who was a keyboard player in Spandau, he was involved with that. That was recorded in America. You know, it was very expensive, but didn't sell as much. So, you know, things happen. But it's a regret. I wish we could have made another album with her, but we didn't, you know.
Frankie Knuckles had mentioned Imagination, the sound of Imagination, as being very influential in the development of house music.
Yeah.
What do you, which is a legacy of what you've achieved as well, but what do you see as your legacy, and what do you think your trademark sound was back in that era of the 80s?
I think that, I mean, it's incredible that you get into the habit of, like, I'm left-handed, and that can make some influence in the way you mix, like with high frequencies. Don't ask me why. So a lot of our tracks would have, you know, hi-hat towards the right, which is where it would be if I was playing the drums, because I'm left-handed, Cabasa on the left, and the bass, the sound of that bass, you know, we use it on other records. When we got to Alison Moyet, the technology, there was a Yamaha DX7, and we used that a lot. So we sort of tended to drop some of those sounds. But yes, I guess the bass. And I've been told that I think Burning Up was the beginning of house, or the piano, you know, the dun, 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 which I played, but I'll be honest with you, I couldn't keep it up. So we tape looped it. You know, we put it on a loop with the bass drum, because I just said, I can't keep this up without a computer and to be spot on. So yeah, it was a tape loop. So, but that, you know, the sort of formation of those chords, which was sort of in the, and the intervals of those chords were probably the very earliest use of that type of piano as a house track, you know. So claim to fame.
Yeah, but why do people love that era of the 80s? It seems to be so many people that love that era. Why was it so special? What is it about it?
It's interesting, because the 80s, people love the 80s. And I said, well, for me, I was in a room with no windows during most of the 80s, you know, making these records. And like, you know, when we went to the Bahamas to record the True album, it was like taking a school trip with the, you know, we were the headmasters and the group and the roadies and everything else. And we stayed in Compass Point and beautiful studios. I barely saw any of it. You know, it was because the studio had no windows, but But you asked me the question, what was it? I have to say, the technology played a big part. The sampling, different synthesizers, the recording techniques were improving, the machines were improving. We were getting, the beginning of the 80s, we had no, there was no, you know, the Fairlight was Synclavier early, but there was no great sampling. We had nothing at the beginning of the 80s and everything at the end of the 80s. You know, you couldn't get a you had to use a real piano if you wanted to play the piano, but the, you know, then we used piano samples. But in real answer to your question, I thought about this myself as why that is. It's the songs. And the songs, if you listen to some of the disco hits of the 80s, you know, coming in from America, whether it's Cool and the Gang or, I mean, Earth, Wind and Fire, my God, September, you know, is still an incredible track. And it's just, you know, it's just sound and the songs combined. And I think with the imagination stuff, that's what we did. And we wrapped it, a pop track, in a dance track, you know. And I think that's it. And I don't think, you know, there are some good songs around, but they're few and far between now. And the genres, you know, the sort of age group, there's no record shops, and there's all the media is being dumped in charity shops, and it's like disposed of as if it's worthless. And I think that it's just changed so much. But but what's interesting is the radio is still playing my records, which I'm very grateful and flattered about. And so that means there's a hunger for this music still, and these songs. But if I wrote a song now that was like something I'd write in the 80s, you know, the record company go, well, what do you expect us to do with that? It's like it has to be old to get played. It's peculiar, you know.
Well, Tony Swain, thank you so much. And I want to again say what I said in the beginning, because you've made such a massive contribution to pop culture and created some of the most beautiful songs of an era that was very important to me, and I'm sure to many other people. So thank you.
Well, Steve, it's been great to talk to you, and I've really enjoyed it. So thank you.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
It's the most wonderful time of the year, Christmas. And what better way to get into the holiday spirit than with a Minky Couture blanket? Whether you're gathered around the tree with loved ones, roasting marshmallows by the fire, or just looking for a cozy way to stay warm on a chilly night, Minky blankets are the perfect addition to your Christmas festivities. With a wide range of festive designs and colors, you can find the perfect blanket to match your holiday decor or gift to your loved ones. So this Christmas, make your holiday even cozier with a Minky Couture blanket. Head to MinkyCouture.com now and find your perfect blanket just in time for the holiday. Happy holidays from Minky Couture.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at usaa.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.